Welcome to today's presentation, the 2016 Legislative Update for Law Enforcement. This webinar is brought to you by the Utah Prosecution Council, the Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training. I'm Christopher Fielding of Post Media Services, and I will be moderating today's webinar. We are also pleased to have with us today Bob Church, Director, Utah Prosecution Council, and Tyson Skeen, Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor, also with the Utah Prosecution Council. We will now turn the time over first to Director Church.
All right.
Director.
Thanks, Chris. You always make me feel so professional calling me Director. I was going to say good afternoon because it's afternoon for me. I don't know when you guys are going to be listening to this, but we appreciate you tuning in and listening to this year's legislative update. Just a little bit about myself, if we haven't met. I've just been the Director of the Prosecution Council now for 2 years, a little over 2 years. Before that, I was a prosecutor with the Orem City Attorney's Office for close to 18. So have had a lot of prosecution experience. Always love working with law enforcement. Tyson's been with us just a short period of time, but I'll let him tell you about him. Oh, by the way, Tyson has a radio face, we understand. So
very good radio face.
Yeah.
So my name's Tyson Skeen, if we haven't met. I've been with the Prosecution Council since January in the position with the TSRP, the Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor. Prior to that, I was a prosecutor for West Jordan City, and prior to that, in Salt Lake City as well. And don't hold it against me, but I did a little bit of defense work out of law school before that, learned some of the tricks of the trade on that side too. So, but many more years as a prosecutor than a defense attorney. So.
Geez, Tyson, if I'd known that, I never would have hired you.
Well, you knew that.
Oh, maybe I did.
It was on my resume.
Oh, that's right. I'm just old. Anyway, this year's legislative update, there's not a lot of criminal, well, not a lot of criminal bills per se. I mean, there were more civil than criminal. And then the ones that are criminal related is obviously what we're going to talk about. But I guess what I was trying to get at is there's not a lot of brand new criminal laws, but I will point that out. If you don't have the materials or want to get the materials, you can go to UPC's webpage, which is at www.upc.utah.gov. In the toolbar, the taskbar up at the top of the page, you'll see, I think it's training. There's a drop-down box, materials, look for legislative update. You click on that link, and then you will see a 2016 and then the word current in parentheses materials. And so you can download that if you want to follow along with us. Tyson and I will give you the House bill or the Senate bill number. And some of these you may actually want to go and take a look at the actual language because we won't go into a lot of specific detail. But you'll be able to look at that if you need to for reference. So the first one that we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk about is House Bill 67. This is dealing with weapons on public transportation. For those of you that have a bus terminal or a public transportation that is in your jurisdiction, it is no longer a felony, a third-degree felony, to simply or to merely carry a concealed dangerous weapon. They've done away with that. So absent some other criminal activity, simply carrying a concealed dangerous weapon on a bus or in a bus terminal is no longer illegal. House Bill 68, this is dealing with post-exposure blood testing amendments. When you are all exposed to blood or bodily fluids in the course of performing your duties, you know, whether with a defendant, a victim, a witness, whatever, you obviously want to get that blood tested to see if there's any type of a communicable disease that you may have been exposed to. In the past, House Bill 68 only said that a district court judge could issue a warrant in those circumstances to get the blood if you've got a defendant or somebody who is unwilling or unable to give consent to provide the blood sample. So the legislature has enhanced that or expanded that, just a little bit. So now it's a district court judge and a magistrate judge that can issue a warrant for a blood draw. So if you've got law enforcement and or first aid providers that have been exposed, you just simply fill out the affidavit as you've been doing in the past, indicating that you are, you know, requesting the warrant, that there's you need to use reasonable force to withdraw the blood, that the person, the officer, first aid provider, has been significantly exposed, that the person has refused to give consent or is unable to give consent, that there may not be an opportunity to get the sample at a later date, and that any delay in administering any FDA-approved post-exposure treatment, prophylactic series, could result in a lack of effectiveness in the treatment. So just that slight change that you can now go to a magistrate judge to get that warrant.
On page 9, House Bill 105, human trafficking revisions, you're going to see that there's quite a few bills here that, although it's new language or new change in the law, it's not going to change how you have mostly been doing things on the law enforcement side. We've always known that this is the case, but they're codifying it here. This is in regards to human trafficking of a child. The law now specifically states that mistakenly believing that a victim is over the age of 18 and not a minor is not a defense to the crime of human trafficking of a child. And again, it's kind of a no-duh moment for us in law enforcement. We never considered that a defense, but now it's codified, and so you are not able to use that as a defense.
This session, there were, you know, a couple of bills dealing with human trafficking. As Tyson and I have been around the state talking about this, we found that there's jurisdictions that, you know, we'd ask, has anybody here dealt with human trafficking? And you know, we'd get a negative response. And some of the smaller jurisdictions just don't think that this is something that is affecting them. But what we have found is that this is an endemic problem that reaches across the state. And if you don't think it's happening in your jurisdiction, it may well be you just, you know, just haven't come across it. So just be aware that human trafficking really is a huge issue here in the state. Over on page 10, House Bill 114, this is the first of a couple of prescription-related bills that aren't really creating any new violations per se, but are dealing with the epidemic here in the state of Utah that the legislature has identified. We now, here in the state of Utah, rank fourth in the nation for overall overdose deaths and first in the nation for military overdose deaths. And so the legislature, as I said, has recognized this really as a health problem. So this bill, House Bill 114, what it has created is a requirement that the administrative office of the court report to DOPPEL any conviction for use or possession of a controlled substance. Now, this doesn't affect the way that you're going to do your jobs, but it may have an effect on the prosecutor's side because there is either intentionally or unintentionally, the legislator left out a conviction for distribution. So if you get a distribution charge, that's not mandatorily, or it's not required to be reported to DOPPEL. So smart guys up on the Hill, the attorneys are thinking that you guys may charge somebody with the use or possession, but they may show up at the attorney's office trying to plead to a distribution charge to avoid that reporting requirement to DOPPEL. Now, we may come back next year and tell you that that's been fixed, but that's just something to be aware of. Over on page 12, House Bill 126, this is dealing with unmanned aircraft or drones. Drones are not going away. They're kind of the, you know, toy of the future. We had legislation last year dealing with it. Under the circumstances, you could collect and keep evidence. This year, what the legislation is dealing with is the use of drones in the vicinity of wildland fires. The FAA has found that drones and drone operators love to go out and watch the wildland fires burn. They like to get cool video of the fire, of the firefighters, but it was causing problems with the ability to fight the fire. So this is the first of the new criminal laws that we've got on the books. So if you are out in a wildland fire, you know, either working it or providing assistance, and you see a drone in the area, and if you can show that it's being recklessly operated, find the operator of the drone, and you can then charge him or her with a Class B misdemeanor. This is an enhanceable offense, and so if the drone actually causes an aircraft that's being used to fight the fire to drop its payload in a different location or to land without being able to drop its payload, then it's a Class A misdemeanor. It jumps up to a third-degree felony if the drone comes into contact with the manned aircraft, and then finally it becomes a second-degree felony if the drone is a proximate cause for the aircraft to collide with the ground, a structure, or another manned aircraft. So the first of our new criminal bills.
And Bob, just on that, I just read an article this morning about one of our fires that's burning in the state. That aircraft had to be landed because there was a drone in the area.
Okay.
Apparently it wasn't scheduled to drop a payload. It wasn't dropping any fire retardant, but yeah, they were doing a scouting mission, just kind of scouting out the fire and seeing what they needed to do and track some things. And they had to land two aircraft because there was a drone in the area. It was just this morning was the article. Huh. And so this is absolutely an issue, and we need to be on the lookout for it. It causes some real problems for our wildland fires.
Right. As an aside, I'm also in the National Guard, and this weekend we had drill and we got an updated briefing on the fire season here in the state of Utah, and we all know that it's hot today.
Yes.
It's going to be hot all summer, so guys that are doing the wildfires, you know, watch out for this if you've got drones in that area.
So on page 13, House Bill 148, there's some protective order amendments. It doesn't really change the protective orders themselves. There's some procedural changes that have taken place, and it's specifically in regards to parties that there's a final decree of divorce, and there's a protective order in place as well. Basically, this is putting in a provision into the law that those protective orders will automatically expire after 10 years if there's a protective order issued and there's a final decree of divorce. There are some provisions that allow it to extend beyond the 10 years if the petitioner can demonstrate that they have a reasonable fear for future abuse, or if the respondent had been convicted of a protective order violation in the past. Those can go beyond the 10 years. But as you're investigating protective orders, especially with divorce parties, there may be automatic sunset provisions in those protective orders now where they are expiring after 10 years. So be aware of that.
Okay, House Bill 149, which is the bottom of page 13 and over onto page 14. This is dealing with access to DOPL databases. For those officers that have been around for a couple of years, you knew that prior to last year, you pretty much had free access to DOPL as you're investigating, you know, what prescriptions people had and things like that. And last year, the legislature did away with that, absent a search warrant. We recognize it was a hindrance to law enforcement, and lots of people didn't like it. Well, this year the legislature has eased back on some of those restrictions. So now if DOPL reaches out to you as an investigator and asks you to investigate for them, or if they want to conduct a joint investigation, then you no longer have to get that warrant to access the DOPL database. It also allows probation and parole officers to access the DOPL database in regards to, you know, those people that either are on parole or probation with them. And so what we've got is officers asking the question, well, can I, you know, join forces and hook up with a parole or probation officer and bring them in on my investigation? And the answer is sure. And so maybe now that's how you can get access to those DOPL bases, but make sure that you're working with that probation or parole officer.
On page 15, House Bill 155, the reporting of child pornography. This is another new criminal act that's been added to our code. It basically defines what a computer technician is, and it's virtually our IT personnel, either public or private agencies. It doesn't matter. Those who are installing software, completing repairs on other people's computers, devices, phones, laptops, whatever it is.
So not Donna's son-in-law? Just comes over and helps her. Helps mom-in-law fix the computer?
Nope, it would be somebody who is involved in doing this for work. Now, if you're paying somebody on the side, then they may be able to fit into that. But
sort of like that, who's the guy that does the PC laptop guy? We love you. His guy. That shop. Yeah, okay.
Yep. But if one of these computer technicians discovers what they believe is child pornography on the other person's device, there's a mandatory report to either law enforcement or the federal tip line. If they do not report that, it is a Class B misdemeanor for failing to report. There are some good faith provisions in the law that allow organizations or companies or departments to set up a reporting policy where you would report it up the chain of command to somebody who does all the reporting instead of the computer technician doing that alone. And then also if the computer technician reasonably believed that the images they saw were people over the age of 18 and then they ended up being minors, that would be a defense to the bill as well. This could be a little tricky to prove. It's going to be difficult to prove in some cases probably what people saw or what they didn't see, especially when they're not reporting it. But if we do come across a situation where somebody, we know they have seen it and they didn't report it, that's a Class B misdemeanor now.
Okay, House Bill 159, they're at the bottom half of page 115. This is dealing with line of duty death benefits. This is not criminal per se. This is just the legislature expanding benefits for surviving spouses. So what it has done is it's eliminated the disqualification of a surviving spouse from receiving state health care benefits if they remarry. What the statute used to be is that the surviving spouse, if they remarried, then they lost those benefits, but they have lifted that. So now if a surviving spouse remarries, they're still eligible until they reach the age of Medicare. And then it left in place that surviving children are eligible for those benefits until they reach the age of 26.
On page 16, House Bill 179, consensual sexual activity with a minor, amendments here. This is a big change for us. It doesn't create any new laws, but there is a change in this. The old code for the Class A misdemeanor, when you were talking about consensual sexual acts with 14 to 16-year-old victims, said a person commits sexual abuse of a minor if the person is 7 years or more older than the victim, or if the defendant is an adult with who holds a special position of trust. The legislature has amended that 7 years down to 4. So be aware that the gap for consensual sexual acts on this Class A misdemeanor is closed from 7 years to 4 years, which could provide for situations where you have an 18-year-old senior in high school that has a boyfriend or a girlfriend that's a 14-year-old freshman. And as long as that gap is, 18 and 6 months and 14 and 5 months, that is now against the law. And so be aware of that. That gap is closed from 7 to 4 years, which could really change how we do investigations in regards to these types of criminal actions. On page 18, House Bill 191, there's some amendments to the affirmative defense available to drivers when they've been ordered to have an interlock device installed on any vehicle they own or drive. There's a provision under the law that allows them to not do so, gives them an affirmative defense to the crime, essentially, if they're operating an employer's vehicle for work. The old law required that you would have to provide written notification to your employer that you were interlock restricted, that you didn't own the company either partially or wholly, and that you were only driving the vehicle for work use and not any personal use. And if you did those things, then you qualified for the affirmative defense that was made available under the law. This bill amends and actually requires the employer to give the written notification or the verification to the driver that the employer is aware of the status as an interlock restricted driver. They're again asserting or certifying that the driver does not own the company, either partially or wholly, and that it is only being used for work purposes. In addition to those requirements, it's requiring that the employer must make their insurance company aware that the interlock or the driver's interlock restricted, and that driver has to be added to the insurance policy. I really think that's going to make it very difficult for people to use this because that's going to cause employers' insurance policies and premiums to go up because they have interlock restricted driver in there. And so I think a lot of people will struggle to meet these requirements now. Just as a practice principle, the advice I've been telling everybody in regards to this is if you come across somebody and they don't have an interlock device and they have all the paperwork showing that they can meet the affirmative defense, I'm telling people to cite them anyways. And the affirmative defense is for the attorneys to fight about down the road. An officer does not have to make that decision on the side of the road. And you never know, they may not have crossed all their T's and dotted all their I's the way that they needed to along the way, and we may be able to find that out down the road in court and discovery and things. And they may not qualify for the affirmative defense, even if they've showed you a paper that looks like they do. Officers do not need to worry about affirmative defenses as they're doing their jobs in everyday police work. That's for the attorneys to worry about down the road. It may result in a dismissal. It may result in the case being kicked down the road anyways. But that's the advice I'm giving people is just cite them anyways and let us sort it out down the road in court.
So in other words, it may be your irresponsible brother-in-law or your son who is going to be on your insurance because your wife says you have to include them and hire them for your job, right?
Yep. I think about the only people who are going to mate this is people who are doing business with family.
Yeah.
Normal employers is not going to want to pay the premiums. So, but if your wife tells you have to, I guess you have to. Page 20, House Bill 206. Human trafficking, safe harbor amendments. This really isn't a law enforcement bill. It's a DCFS bill, but we wanted to make you aware of it because it may impact some of your how cases are handled down the road. We've discovered, and Bob mentioned this earlier about the human trafficking and certain things, but it's being discovered that a lot of juveniles who are getting in trouble in these situations are actually being trafficked, and they're actually victims of human trafficking. And if we have a situation where it's discovered that somebody's involved in either the sex trade, drugs, labor, those things, anything that's against the law, and the juvenile gets picked up and we figure out that they're being trafficked, they will not be able to do delinquency proceedings against that juvenile for those things. And it requires certain things that DCFS will have to provide, services that they will have to provide for the juveniles. Some of those were in the old law, but these are much more specific and open to everybody in these situations. And so be aware, your role won't change. You'll still take them to a detention or a receiving center, and then this law will require DCFS to be involved and help sort out the details down the road. But some really good, I think, foresight that our legislature has taken with some of these trafficking and some of the things we're learning about human trafficking in our state.
Okay, over on over on page 22 and 23, House Bill 238, this is the third of these semi-criminal prescription bills that we're going to deal with. What this one does is it expands the definition of who an opiate response overdose provider is, or an outreach provider. The statute actually just says an individual is the new language, but as you go further down, and it talks about that medical providers, pharmacists, can prescribe naloxone or Narcan, you know, is another name for it, the drug that they use in the opiate overdose. And what it does is it provides a safe haven for those that administer naloxone or Narcan to somebody that has, OD'd on opiates. So this isn't something you need to be aware of. You may respond out on an overdose. You may find that a family or even a friend is in possession of the Narcan or the naloxone and has administered it to somebody that's OD'd, and that now is legal for them to possess that and to administer that.
Over on page 26, top of page 26, this is my favorite bill of the legislative session here, and I get a kick out of it every time I see it or talk about it. House Bill 260. This bill clarifies that if you are an attorney, a law enforcement officer, a court employee, or a juror, and you're required to view child pornography in the course of your service, either in employment or service as a juror, that you are not guilty of the crime of sexual exploitation of a minor. And again, that's one of those where we're like, well, yeah, no duh. Laws become laws for a reason, and I don't know if this became a problem somewhere. But if you've ever thought that in doing a child pornography investigation, you were going to walk out of your office and get arrested by one of your fellow department members because you had to view child pornography in that, you can rest easier. If you're ever on a jury and you have to look at the child pornography as part of your duties as a jury, you're safe to walk out to your car without getting arrested. And so, again, just a great use of time, I think, up on the legislature for this bill. It's just my favorite. It is going to have a huge impact on everything we do.
I don't know. My favorite, I think, didn't get passed, was the one that the legislature wanted to pass into law that said that you are presumed innocent until found guilty at trial. And I thought that one was pretty good, but for some reason that didn't get passed into law.
That makes sense, too, because the 200-plus years of constitutional law that says that probably isn't good enough. So maybe next year.
Maybe next year.
We can set lofty goals for next year. House Bill 263, again on page 26, fraud amendments. There's a small change to the language on this, but it broadens the scope of how we can investigate and prosecute the transferring of other people's identification documents, which is a third-degree felony. The old law used to just say transfers, you're guilty if you transfer an identification document. It now says transfers or possesses with intent to transfer an identification document. So that small change in language broadens it because we no longer have to wait for the exchange or the transfer to officially take place, so long as we have other evidence to show that that person intended to transfer that identification document, we can make the arrest, we can do the prosecution. So a small change, but it could have a big impact on some of our fraud cases.
House Bill 300 over on page 28, this is dealing with body cameras. Like drones, body cameras are not going away, and like legislation for drones, we're going to continue to get body-worn camera legislation. For those agencies that already have body cameras, you need to make sure that your smart guys in your department that are setting policy look at this statute, because the statute does say that departments that are using body cameras already, that they have to have written policies governing the use of the body-worn cameras that either meet or exceed the guidelines provided in this statute. For those agencies that don't have them yet, as you begin to delve into body cameras, you don't need to reinvent the wheel in terms of policies. Reach out to some of the other agencies that have them already, and then you can tailor them to your own individual jurisdiction. The bill also provides minimum guidelines when the body cameras need to be activated and when they can be deactivated. The preferences for activation, You know, we as prosecutors, we like to get as much information as possible. That's when you get really great statements from victims and witnesses, excited utterances, and present sense impression, and all these other evidentiary terms that we use in court. But it does provide or recognizes that there are going to be times when you want to turn the video recording or turning the body camera off. And so these are the exceptions in the statute. If you can turn it off, if you've got a substantial period of inactivity during your investigation, you can turn it off if you are consulting with a supervisor, with another officer that doesn't pertain to the investigation. If you're having a conversation with a sensitive victim of a crime, a witness of a crime, or you're having a conversation with an individual and they request that you turn the camera off, you can turn it off. Again, our preference is that you leave it on. And so what that requires is the officer to just go through a balancing test to determine, does the need for the evidence outweigh the request of the privacy? So you'll, you know, give your officer some discretion there. It also has some certain explicit prohibitions of things that you cannot do with a body camera. The first one is you can't use it for your own personal pleasure. So if you don't have a GoPro and you want to go out and get some video footage of, you know, your skateboarding, riding your four-wheeler, skiing, snowboarding, whatever, you cannot use your department-issued body camera. Also can't make a personal copy of any recording that you make while on duty in your official capacity. You can't keep a copy for yourself. You can't duplicate it or distribute it. And then finally, you can't alter or delete a recording unless it's in compliance with the GRAMA statute, the Government Records Access Management Act, or your own internal department policies. And speaking of GRAMA, GRAMA is an area of the law that most attorneys hate. For those supervisors out there, anybody that's listening that has had to respond to a GRAMA request to provide documents, you know that it can be a pain in the rear end. But what the bill does is it addresses video and audio recordings that are made by law enforcement inside of a home or a residence. And what the statute says is that those recordings are normally going to be private recordings and thus receive the highest protection, if you will, under GRAMA. But there are certain recordings, both audio and video, that will not necessarily be categorized as private. The first one is if it depicts the commission of an alleged crime. Second, if it shows an encounter between you, the law enforcement officer, and a person that results in death or bodily injury, or it includes footage of the officer discharging your weapon. Next is if it records an encounter between you and somebody who later files a complaint against you or a legal proceeding. You know, they whine and complain that you were mean to them or used harsh language or, you know, some other thing. We obviously want to take a look at that video footage. The fourth one is if it involves any officer-involved critical incident, and then the last exception is if the person who is the subject of the recording requests that it be declassified down, such as a public or a protected record, then it loses that private status. Let's see. What's
over next? On page 33, House Bill 344, some move-over amendments. Law enforcement, you already understand that the public has a duty. If you have somebody pulled over on the side of the road, or if there's a tow truck on the side of the road, any other emergency vehicles on the side of the road, that other drivers, as they're approaching those situations, they must reduce their speed and provide as much space as possible. And if practical, they are supposed to change lanes into an adjacent lane to give even more room. And nothing changed in regards to that. This bill directly says that if somebody, and it only applies up here on the Wasatch Front where we have the HOV lane, but where if person is pulled over, or one of these emergency vehicles are on the left side of the freeway adjacent to the HOV lane, that a driver can cross a double white line to give the more, to give that emergency situation more room. I don't anticipate any officers would have wanted to go pull somebody over in a situation like that. Kind of be a little bit of a jerk move if they're getting over to give
hey,
you room. And
it's investigation.
But realize that it's not against the law to cross that double white line to provide the more room under this statute. I was asked if the statute addresses when they can move back into the HOV lane, and it is not, to my knowledge. But again, if they move over and they get over and then they move across the double white line back, it's probably best to just tip your hat to them and say, thank you for helping me be safe, and let them go along their way. But the bill, to my knowledge, does not address when they can move back in. I don't know if it gives them a safe harbor to move back in or if they have to wait until there's a break. So
Actually, Tyson, let's go back to body cameras for a minute. Okay. I forgot to mention that when you do turn your camera off, you've got to document it. As prosecutors, and especially defense counsel, the media, if we're looking at some footage and all of a sudden it stops recording, you know, and there's a jump in time, as we have got to know that. And Tyson, share what you found out, the research, you know, with the legislation last year, because what almost happened last year, what we're trying to avoid.
So one of the provisions in the bill that was attempted to get passed in the 2015 session by the same legislator who ran this bill was that if there was any altering, deleting, editing of a video, or if the officer failed to capture video, so just if there wasn't video, that there was going to be a rebuttable presumption that something favorable to the defendant would have been contained on that video. And that would have been an absolute nightmare for us as prosecutors, as we're trying to talk to juries or judges down the road, and we have no evidence to rebut that presumption. It just would have been presumed under the law that something favorable to the defendant would have been on that video. You know, I presented this last week and had some advice. A question was asked in a place where we're at, what if you're in a period of inactivity where you could have turned off your video, but you didn't, and some things that you maybe said some things that you wish that you wouldn't have got recorded. Can you edit those? And the answer is no. Once it's recorded, you don't edit anything. We had a brief discussion last week in some task force meetings about this. You just need to be careful. And it goes to body cams, to dash cams, whatever it is. You know, you're doing a DUI investigation. Don't have Loveline on as you're doing field sobriety tests and have that entire thing recorded in some of those discussions that are going on, or other talk shows that could be, I don't know, political talk shows, things like that. Let's just avoid all that stuff. We've got to be really careful. I know you guys have a hard job. I know that some of these things just happen, and if they do, we deal with it. And sometimes we all say, and we as prosecutors do it too, we get a little calloused in our jobs, and we say things that we get, but the general public, it probably doesn't look good if it's on the front page of the newspaper or on the leading story of the news. And we just need to be really careful in what we're saying out there and what we're getting recorded, because once it's there, it's there. We're not editing or deleting any of those things out.
Yeah, we just don't want you to be that guy that results in bad legislation.
Yep.
Okay, over on page 37, House Bill 381. This is the second of the duh statute. So maybe this is, you know, one of my favorites as well. But what this one does is it just codifies what you guys are already doing. And so let me put my sarcasm hat on here for just a minute as we go through this. What this statute, well, I guess sarcasm hat's not on quite yet. But what the statute says is that the legislature prefers that in a case that you're investigating, you know, you didn't witness the crime, you're not taking somebody into custody, you're just simply investigating after the fact, that the preference is that instead of issuing a warrant for their arrest, that you issue a summons. But if you have to issue a warrant for their arrest, then you have to put the following things into your affidavit. And so I haven't yet found an officer that's not putting each one of these things in your PC, in your affidavit, excuse me. But if you're one of those guys, then maybe the statute's for you, because as Tyson said, you know, there's usually a reason for a statute. But anyway, so if you have decided that you need to get a warrant for somebody's arrest rather than issuing a summons, you have to include the following in your affidavit. And so just chime up, you know, real loud if you're not including any of these things in your affidavit. One, do you have probable cause to believe that the person committed the crime? Let's see, next, that you believe that a warrant is necessary to prevent injury to persons or property. Anybody yet? Okay. How about you want the warrant so that you can secure their presence, meaning that they're a flight risk? And then finally, you know, to protect public welfare, safety, etc. So if you haven't been including any of those in your affidavit already, then shame on you. Otherwise, just continue to do what you have been doing.
On the same page, page 37, House Bill 404, Crime Victim Restitution Amendments. Again, this is not a bill that's going to impact how you as law enforcement do things, but just to make you aware, we had a Supreme Court decision that resulted from our restitution statute, and it basically interpreted the statute to say that costs incurred in cooperating with the prosecution or the criminal proceedings could not be ordered as restitution. And the legislature, because they have the power to change the legislation, went in this year and changed that. And now, in result of that case that we have, Basically, it says that costs reasonably incurred as a result of participation in the criminal proceedings can be ordered as restitution by the court. It also changed the time frame in regards to restitution. It used to have to be ordered by the court within 1 year of sentencing. Now it only has to be requested within the 1 year. And if we go over that year before the court gets a restitution hearing scheduled or makes a decision, we're still going to be okay. Again, it's not something necessarily that will impact how you do your day-to-day work, but if you're dealing with victims and talking with victims and trying to help them and they're asking questions, you can at least inform them of these changes to the law. That's it for our House bills. On to the Senate bills.
Woohoo!
On page 50, Senate Bill 106, there's an amendment to the assault statute. Now, anybody who commits an assault where it's intentional, acts intentionally or knowingly, and causes substantial bodily injury, that's always been a Class A misdemeanor for the public, for everybody else, except for law enforcement. Law enforcement, it's an enhancement to a third-degree felony if you do that on a law enforcement officer. This bill broadens that language to add our emergency responders, medical personnel, hospital staff, healthcare providers to that. So the same enhancement that is available under law to protect law enforcement is now available to those people as well. If somebody, you know, it doesn't even have to be your defendant. If a family member shows up to the hospital upset and punches a nurse and causes substantial injury, that's now a third-degree felony. And so be aware of that change. This has caught some real media attention on the news and in some of the online and newspapers. Afterwards, the last few weeks, they've talked about this a lot, and the medical personnel and field is very happy about these changes. So be aware that of the enhanced penalty now to a third-degree felony for our medical responders.
Over on page 53, Senate Bill 124, this is an easy one. They've just added some new language to the gang enhancement. So if you are investigating a crime and you can show that two or more people acted in concert and retaliated against a witness, a victim, or an informant, you can gang enhance that crime that you're investigating. So that's a simple one there. Let's see.
Over on page 59, Senate Bill 157, we have some pawn shop amendments that have taken place. Now, anybody who's ever worked a theft case that deals with a pawn shop, you probably have the exact same story that goes on. Is you have a victim, the original owner of the property, who's the victim of the crime. They have their stuff stolen. They're able to identify it through serial numbers, pictures, whatever. You go and you put your law enforcement hold on that item at the pawn shop. And the pawn shops are super willing to work with us, and they're super happy to give that property back if the victim just comes and buys it from them.
Yeah.
And so that's how it's been for some time. This law changed a little while ago and allowed for pawn shops to now charge for victims to come and get their property back. Well, this is reining in that practice a lot. I was going to say a little, but it is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you how this is going to go, and it will really help our original victims of the crime and the original owners of the property. So if you're able to identify the owner and the original owner of the property and a victim of a theft, you can get with your prosecution agency, whether it's the city or the county, depending on what level of theft you're dealing with here, whoever's going to be prosecuting that theft, get written notification from them that you're able to release the property, that they don't need it held in evidence for trial purposes or whatever. Email's fine with this. It doesn't have to be a written letter. But once you get that, then you can go and you can provide, it says you shall promptly provide notice to the pawn shop or secondhand business that within 15 days they need to release that property to the original owner of that crime. Now, pawn shops can dispute this. They can challenge this. They can go to file a petition in district court to try and assert themselves as the rightful owner of that property at that point. If they do that within the 15 days, we're out of the game. We'll wait to see what the court decides, and then it's completely up to the court. And if the court says that the original owner gets their property back, they get it back. If they don't, and says that the pawn shop is a rightful owner now, then we just go with what the court says, as always. But if they do nothing, if they don't challenge it, if they don't try to go to court to assert themselves as the rightful owner, if they're refusing to give the property back to that original owner, after the 15 days notice, you can go in and you can cite the pawn shop with a Class B misdemeanor. This is another new law that we're able to do. And at that point, you have evidence of a Class B misdemeanor. You can seize the evidence at that point and just take it because it's evidence of your crime. You can go book it into your holding and then again get a release from your prosecutor to get it back to the original owners. This probably has a tendency and will have a tendency to kick a little bit of a hornet's nest with the pawn shops. I'm sure they're not going to love this. You still are very much able, once you give them notice, to do a theft by deception case for the pawn shop. They're going to be victims of this crime at this point now, too. So try to work with the pawn shops on this. Try to get them to know that you're on the same team with them. But we are going to be protecting original owners of property in this, and it's my belief that if pawn shops are not complying with this 15-day notice and they're refusing to release property, that we go in and we cite them, we enforce this law. They've been able to run a little bit roughshod with some of these things. Some of the pawn shops are really good to work with, some are not, and it's something that we really need to take seriously and enforce if we want to see real changes for original owners of property on that. Over on page 65, reclassification of misdemeanors, Senate Bill 187. Last year, in 2015, we had a grundle of sections of the code that were reduced from Class C misdemeanors to infractions, from Class Bs to Class Cs, just a huge amount of felonies to Class As, obviously, as we saw with the Controlled Substance Acts and things like that. This is kind of a continuation of that. There were 43 codes impacted by this. 42 were reduced from Class C misdemeanors to infractions. One was increased from an infraction back to a Class C misdemeanor. It has to do with boating and steering navigation laws. But the biggest one that's probably going to impact people here is speeding. Speeding was left off the list last year. It has been reduced to an infraction in the state code.
Hallelujah.
Yes, for prosecutors, that's a hallelujah. What you'll find is I don't think this is going to change anything for you guys. People weren't going to jail for these. Judges weren't sentencing people to jail for these anyways, for the most part. I guess there may have been times when it did happen. The reality is you can still take somebody and book them into jail for an infraction committed in your presence. The jails will not hold them. It will be a book and release, but you do have the ability to do that as an officer. And so that doesn't even change anything in regards to that. On page 66, but let me back up. Go and take a look at that because there are quite a few laws and we're not going to talk about all of them here today. So go ahead and look at that. We hyperlink on our website that Bob mentioned earlier on upc.utah.gov and the legislative
Nice
update.
Plug for our webpage.
Hey, yeah, go there, visit it. Click on the TSRP section. It's great. Senate Bill 194, page 66. This just clarifies, and I think most officers viewed this as the law anyways. There's two parts to it. Only one applies to us here, that if somebody's driving a rental vehicle, the rental agreement counts as a temporary registration. So if you are asking somebody for license, registration, insurance, whatever, and they're driving a rental vehicle, that will suffice for temporary registration under the law, is that rental agreement. And then on page 67, Senate Bill 206, there's been some amendments to the Cohabitant Abuse Procedures Act, and there's quite a few things that were changed. But for you as law enforcement, there's only one thing that I think you really need to be aware of. In the Cohabitant Abuse Procedures Act, when you're doing domestic violence investigations, there's a lot of things that officers have to do under the law. The legislature's taken away the discretion and has a lot of shalls. There's a lot of shalls in that act that require certain things, mandatory arrests, mandatory investigations, different things like that. There's a new shall in this provision. Now, something that has always been a shall, well, not always, but before this legislative session has been a shall, is officers are supposed to be making victims aware that they have the right to waive a jail release agreement. Now, many of you are handing out pamphlets, and your victim advocates are coming out and handing out pamphlets, and that information is contained in that. In most of these pamphlets that I've seen, at least. The new shall that is in this law requires officers to make the magistrate aware if the victim was made aware that they can notify the jail release agreement. Now, the only way that I know that you will be able to do this because you're not having constant contact with your magistrates is in your PC statement. So when you take somebody to jail and you book them in on any domestic violence-related crime, you need to make a note in your PC statement. It can be the last line, however you want to do it. But essentially, that the victim was made aware that they have the right to waive the jail release agreement. This is just one of the things that they're trying to do. I think the legislature has seen that a lot of jail release agreements were outstanding. They really aren't meant to be a permanent protective order. They're supposed to be very temporary to allow prosecutors to get pretrial protective orders and allow victims to go and get district court protective orders, ex parte protective orders. And they're just supposed to be a stopgap. And some of this is trying to clean that up. So be aware of that. That's a new change. It's something any officer who books somebody into jail on domestic violence related offenses needs to do now. And that is it.
It is. Wow. Record time.
Yes.
We want to thank you guys for listening. For those that don't know Tyson, he is the new Ed Berkovich, if you remember Ed. And so Tyson is ready and willing to answer any questions, so please get a hold of him. Many of you may know Donna Kelly. She's my domestic violence resource prosecutor, sexual assault resource prosecutor. And the same thing is if you've got any questions for her, please reach out to us. Again, the final plug for our webpage, upc.utah.gov. And that's one way that you can get a hold of us if you don't already have our phone number. So until next year, when we see out locally, thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys. Be safe out there.
Yep. Take care.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Director Church and Tyson Skeen with the Utah Prosecution Council for this presentation. On behalf of the Utah Prosecution Council, the Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training, thank you for listening in today. If you'd like more information on previous and upcoming training events, we invite you to log on to the ACADIS training portal and search under the registration tab. Again, thank you for listening.